Critics agree. Bring Back Birdie is tasteless and ridiculous, woefully tired, plodding, commonplace, depressing, dull, desperate, confused, satirically toothless, and far inferior to its predecessor. Clive Barnes says the show is about as engaging as a wet flounder on a dry night, and Frank Rich says the plot devolves into total chaos. Stay tuned. Bring Back Birdie is next on Flop of the Heap.
Flop of the Heap's mission is not to bash, rip, pan, grill, or flambé the subjects we explore.
Nor are we here to put performers and other artists down.
More importantly, we also recognize that part of the creative process is failure, and believe facing those failures with a critical but genial attitude should be the norm.
There can be no success without failure.
After all, you can't spell hopeful without... flop.
We love you, Jonbo. Oh, yes, we do.
Inner peace. Inner peace.
This show is a hot train wreck.
This is gonna be a good... It's been a long time since we've had a musical with this bad of a plot.
Yeah, this one is truly flopperunio. I saw Suffs. I thought it was really good.
So this is how last night went after you told us that.
Mm-hmm.
We decided we wanted to see a show for our anniversary, mm-hmm. and I had a list. The list was, you added Suffs to it. Suffs was originally not on it.
Okay.
Limpika.
It's on my list.
The Tommy Revival.
Yes.
And,
now, I want to see Water for Elephants. Oh, yes, Merrily.
And Water for Elephants and Merrily. Okay, We Roll Along.
Merrily is great. Tour. So you bought a ticket for Merrily.
Yes, we got Merrily, but... you know, Water for Elephants, any show that has circus stuff, you know I'm right there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited for that.
What did you like about Suffs?
What did I like about it? I went in not knowing really anything. Of course, I knew it was about the suffragist movement. I knew that, what's her name? Emily Skinner is in it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that Jen Colella was in it.
I mean, she's one of the main reasons I want to go.
Oh my God, she's so good. She's so good.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny. The audience laughed a lot. I also thought it was very moving. I definitely was moved to tears in the second act. I liked...
Did it feel too much like Hamilton?
It never really dawned on me that it was Hamilton-esque until kind of the ending, once they were kind of on their hunger strike. It got a little intense, and I was thinking, oh, this... it looks and sounds a little bit like Hamilton, but it's not. The style of the music is more, you know, some of it is turn of the century ragtimey, and some of it is more standard musical theater fare. But it's certainly not hip hop. I mean, it doesn't have that flair to it.
Got it.
I thought it was a diverse company. I mean, it's all women, of course, but I thought there was, you know, there's. Differing ability representation, there's trans representation, there's race representation, it's all kind of in there, women playing men. I mean, it was just, it's a really good piece of theater. I thought to myself, wow, what a great, you know, book in the catalog for high schools, you know, where you always have a million girls that want to perform and you have to beg the boys to come out, you know.
I guess my question, my biggest question is how, you say it's diverse.
Mm-hmm.
How did they handle the bad parts of the suffragist movement? You know, it was very anti-black and
I thought it was
extremely exclusionary.
I thought it was handled very well. There are, I believe, three black women that, you know, bring that part of the story in a accurate light. It shows the political infighting between the women. It shows how black women were left out. It shows how they were, you know, forced to march at the back of the parade and all that stuff. It definitely comments on all that stuff. And the black characters do have, you know, solo moments where they come together and get to tell their story, which I thought was strong.
Okay.
And then despite the fact that the accurate races are playing historically accurately themselves, there is some blind casting as far as a black woman playing a white man. And I don't know, I thought it was really well done. You kind of just accept the whole thing.
Yeah, I was just sort of, because, you know, when you have a very diverse cast like that, especially something historical, mm-hmm. What often ends up happening is simply that it becomes simply like, we're going to whitewash the shit out of this and everyone is whatever. And I'm like, but race was kind of important.
I think they did not gloss over the topic of race.
All right. That makes me more.
I really wanting
to see it.
But yeah, really good. I highly recommend it. I hope you get a chance to see it as well. Okay, the biggest thing to learn from this whole debacle is that when you force someone to write a musical against their will, terrible things happen.
Oh, God. You know Bye Bye Birdie was my first musical, right, that I ever performed in?
I was going to ask if you had done Birdie. I didn't remember it was your first show, no.
Yeah, so this will be fun.
I've never done Birdie. I have to say it's never been one of my super favorites. I understand why it's done, you know, all the time.
It's not done anymore, though. It's so dated. No one today cares about... It's not culturally relevant, Elvis going to be drafted, right?
Right, but I still think it's done a lot. Anyway, we decided to do this terrible idea for a sequel after Cheetah Rivera passed away. She died the end of January, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Broadway legend. So, shall we?
We shall.
Okay. We're talking today about Bring Back Birdie, the sequel to Bye Bye Birdie. Let's Google all night.
Okay.
I could have Googled all night. I could have Googled all night. And still, I have begged for more. Thank you.
That's
Thank
good.
You very much.
It's a good Thank birdie.
You. All right. So, opening date.
March 5th, 1981.
Closing?
March 7th, 1981. Oh,
3 days. 3 days. 31 previews, 4 performances. Oof.
Mm-hmm.
What theater did it play at?
The Martin Beck, which is now the Al Hirschfeld.
Correct. The same theater that Bye Bye Birdie played in.
They really thought this whole like idea of being like, oh, it'll be a sequel 20 years later in the same place with the same people.
Mm-hmm.
They really were banking off of this like nostalgia for the original and this cool like, we're going to do it all the same, but new and did not happen.
If the show weren't a hot train wreck of a plot, it might have been able to bank on its nostalgia.
I have a good question.
What?
Is this, so you know how when they do revivals of TV shows today, like ones from like the early 2000s and 90s?
Oh, yes.
Like they just pick up like 20 years later?
Yeah.
Was that a common thing back then? Or is this like the start of that trend?
Okay. I don't think there has ever been a musical sequel that has worked. You know, Annie Warbucks was a notorious mess. Bring Back Birdie is a mess.
Let Him Eat Cake.
Yes, Yvette. Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public, I guess, was from this time period. And I want to point out, like, every single nonsense that came after the original nonsense. Did you know there were 6 f***ing sequels?
I thought there were only, like, 2.
There's 6.
Are you checking?
There's Nonsense. Nonsense 2, The Second Coming. Nonsense 3, Sister Amnesia's Country Western Nonsense Jamboree. Nuncrackers, the Nonsense Christmas Musical. Of course, then there's Meshuggah Nuns.
No.
Yes. Nun Sensations.
That's a hate crime.
It is. Nun Sensations, the Nonsense Vegas Review, and Nunset Boulevard. And of course, we can't.
Nunset Boulevard!
I mean, the titles are better than the shows.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so.
What is played at the Martin Beck / Al Hirschfeld?
I don't know.
Okay, I got you.
We've talked about it before, though.
I'll swoop in, save the day.
All right, thank
it's
you.
Currently Moulin Rouge. It was Kinky Boots,
right.
Candide, and the original Bye Bye Birdie.
Okay. Oh, I Had a Ball and The Rink. We've talked about it before.
So, Cheetah again.
Yeah. Oh, Cheetah's had some not so fun
times in the Martin Beck.
Yeah. All right. What other shows were running in 1981 or early 1981?
So all I could find really was Barnum. There were a lot of revivals. Barnum seemed to be like one of the only newer shows that was running.
Yes. So Barnum was a hit, also directed by Joe Layton, and, you know, booked by Michael Stewart.
Michael Stewart,
who did the book for Bring Back Birdie. So, yeah, there were a couple of revivals of things. The Pirates of Penzance revival was kind of the big thing running on Broadway, the one with Kevin Klein and Linda Ronstadt. David Merrick had just opened the 42nd Street production the year prior, which was running and would run for years. Evita was running.
Okay.
And ironically, the year before, there was a production of The Music Man at, I think it was a City Center revival, mm-hmm. starring Dick Van Dyke as Harold Hill,
oh.
who would then go on tour with The Music Man and would not reprise
his role as Albert Peterson
in Bring Back Birdie. He wisely turned this offer down. I believe he was offered the job first, but I don't know whether Music Man interfered or whether he was just like, nah.
Smart guy.
Smart move.
Okay. Music by Charles Strauss.
Yes.
Still alive at 95. Our composer and lyricist are still alive.
Oh, yes. Lee Adams, still alive as well.
99.
Okay. So Charles Strauss is known for Annie, Applause, Golden Boy. He's really known for a lot more flops. I mean, particularly past, I guess, after Applause, he... You know, there was that Broadway musical disaster, which we haven't done yet. Charlie and Algernon, Dance a Little
Rags.
Closer, Rags, Nick and Nora. There's a show called Mayor. Have you ever heard of this?
I don't know anything about it. No.
Apparently it's about Mayor Koch and Leona Helmsley.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So Ed Koch was mayor in New York 78 till 89. So anyway,
he was the schlubby Jew with his sleeves rolled up.
Correct.
Didn't give a f- about what he said. I'd give anything to have him as mayor again.
Okay, so there's a musical called Mayor with music by Charles Strauss that we have to add it to the list.
I feel like I've said this before. Charles Strauss also did the music for All Dogs Go to Heaven, which is like one of my favorites.
Oh yeah, that's true. Oh, you can't keep a good dog. So Adams did the original Birdie and the sequel with Strauss. He also did Golden Boy with Strauss. It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, Applause, All American, which is a flop we haven't covered yet. That's the one with Ray Bolger and the football team. He also did that Broadway musical disaster. Okay, and then book by Michael Stewart, who was doing really, really well at the time because he had written the book for Barnum, which was a big hit, and the book for 42nd Street, which had just opened the year before. So
yeah.
Michael Stewart was like, you know, kind of the king of Broadway at the moment because there wasn't a lot
going on.
And Strauss and Adams were kind of hoping for another hit, but didn't get there with this.
Can we just talk about how this musical came to be to begin with?
Yeah, go.
So, Birdie came out in 1960.
Yeah.
20 years later, in 1980, it was still the most produced musical in America.
Correct.
Tams Whitmark, who owned the rights to the show for giving it to theaters, was like, this is great, but we want more money. Can we just get like a shitty sequel, just throw it together for amateur productions?
Yeah.
And then the producers were like, nah, this is fire. And we're like, we're bringing this to Broadway. It was literally made for amateur theaters.
But money is the root of all evil. And the producers were like, let's see if we can get a Broadway run out of it. And they were wrong. Now, the producers, it was the same people that produced that ill-fated production of Sherry. And the same people that turned... Gentlemen Prefer Blondes into Lorelei as a vehicle for Carol Channing. Yeah, it was a bad idea. It was definitely a bad idea.
Yeah. Should we discuss the cast?
Yeah, let's.
Cheetah Rivera as Rosie again.
Yes.
Donald O'Connor as Albert, most known for the Make 'em Laugh scene in Singing in the Rain, which he also choreographed. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Yeah.
Donald O'Connor, you know, he never was the biggest Hollywood name. He had a few MGM musicals over the years, but that's really kind of his standout role was Cosmo Brown in Singing in the Rain.
Yeah.
So when Dick Van Dyke turned the role down, I guess they wanted somebody with a similar kind of appeal.
Morris Hines as Mtobi, which is like this detective that has no business being in the show. Like the role does nothing.
Yeah, that is a really weird role. So Maurice Hines is Gregory Hines' older brother.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of a tap dancing duo. They had done Yubi. And I think Maurice Hines just died last year as well. Gregory Hines died back in like early 2000s. Okay, so Maria Karnilova played Mae Peterson. She's Broadway's original Golda in Fiddler and Tessitura in Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
So for the titular role of Conrad Birdie himself, they hired a little-known professional Elvis impersonator named Marcel Forestieri, who currently makes his living doing live impressions of Donald J. Trump.
This is the greatest. Did you know they were considering Rip Taylor?
What?
For Birdie? Yeah.
No, what? Why?
They brought Rip Taylor in to be seen for it.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Oh my God. Okay, so if the first time they did Bye Bye Birdie and Conrad was supposed to be like suggestive of Elvis, this time they went full on Elvis impersonator.
Yeah.
And, you know, this of course is 20 years later, so the joke here is that Conrad is late 70s fat Elvis. He's no longer, you know, he's a Vegas Elvis. He's not young, sexy Elvis anymore.
Yeah. What there was a song they took out of the show called Don't Say F-A-T Around Conrad or something like that.
That's right, yeah. God, I wish I could have found a recording of that. Okay, so Albert and Rosie have two kids who are, like, teenagers in this, you know, 20 years later sequel. Jenny, the daughter, is played by an actor named Robin Morse. And I only just found out this morning that Robin Morse is the daughter of Robert Morse, J. Pierpont Finch.
We literally just watched How to Succeed in Business last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I love Robert Morse. He's so freaking cute.
Yeah. Luna loved it. I was like, you're going to like this. You're a business person. You're going to love this.
A fellow named Evan Seplow plays Albert Jr. He's the son. And Linda Ferguson plays Rose 2, which is part of this insane plot that we will
get to. Yeah. Okay, should we do the plot?
Is there a recording of the show? Yes, although it's very hard to find. There has never been a revival, and it did not win any awards, but Cheetah was nominated for a Tony and a Drama Desk for her return as Rosie.
Of course she was.
Yeah.
Let's give a quick rundown of the plot of the original Birdie first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Conrad Birdie is this Elvis-type character. He's going to the army. Conrad is Albert Peterson's client. Rosie, Albert's secretary, is his love interest, convinces him to go to for Birdie to go to a small town, get some girl from his fan club to give him a last kiss on the Ed Sullivan Show, for this publicity stunt to premiere his new song, One Last Kiss.
Yes.
Oh, one last kiss. Oh, give me one last kiss. It never felt like this.
Albert's mom shows up to break up their relationship because of Rosie's Hispanic heritage. Hugo, the boyfriend of the girl that's supposed to be kissed, Kim, gets jealous and punches Birdie during the broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
Rosie leaves Albert out of jealousy. Birdie gets arrested for attempted statutory rape.
Oh.
With the girl he's supposed
to
kiss.
No wonder it's the most popular high school show of all time.
Albert, wonderful human that he is, what a piece of shit, bails Birdie out of jail, gets him and his mother on a train and out of town, and then goes back to Rosie and is like, promising for this small town married life, end of show.
I was never crazy for flowers.
Oh, in case you don't know, Birdie is most known for Put on a Happy Face and Kids. What's the matter with kids today?
Didn't know what puberty was till I was almost past it. Okay,
now,
so
can I read Can I read the opening to the show? What was the narrator?
Oh, yes. Narrator lines from, yes, because, you know, you can't have a musical sequel without a little overture exposition.
Once upon a time, so long ago that New York hadn't even been bankrupt once, there lived a young man in the music business named Albert Peterson, who loved his secretary, Rose. His only client, a rock and roll idol known as Conrad Birdie, was being drafted into the army. And Rose wanted Albert to give up the music business, marry her, and become an English teacher. Alas, Albert's mother, a frail and gentle old lady with many of the same endearing qualities as Cinderella. Snow White's stepmother.
Oh, wait, Snow White's doesn't have a stepmother.
I don't understand any of this.
It should be Cinderella's stepmother.
This is literally what I pulled word for.
Oh my God, the first line of the show doesn't even make any sense.
Opposed the match. But love triumphed. The mother was banished. Albert married his Rose and became an English teacher, and they all lived happily ever after. Ominous chord. John, give me an ominous chord. Till now.
Okay. So, the plot of Bring Back Birdie.
Oh, it's so...
Okay, jump in at any time to bring in a detail.
Yeah.
20 years have gone by. Albert Peterson is now an English teacher. Albert's mother is missing. Rosie goes by Rose now, and her kids are 16 and 14 and have lives of their own. Conrad has disappeared 18 years ago after he was discharged from the army. It's never explained why. Albert wants to relocate the long-forgotten Conrad Birdie to make an appearance on an awards show so that he can make $20,000. Okay, mm-hmm. No, I'll just give you the $20,000. Don't do this. Okay, so now I get confused because nothing after this makes sense. a random detective named Mtobe shows up. And he finds the old contract, which then allows them to go to Arizona to find Conrad. Okay.
You're doing good. You're doing great.
Okay. Arizona.
I believe in you.
I love the set designer. Is going to be thrilled to make it. I believe in you. Great.
I believe in you.
Okay, so when Albert and Rosie are away, the kids are supposed to go stay with, like, their aunt in New Jersey, but instead, get this, the daughter joins a cult, and the son joins a punk rock band called Filth.
Mm-hmm.
okay, just to make sure I'm not missing anything. It's those two things are important, well, quote-unquote important, they'll come back later. So, next thing that happens, out of the f***ing blue, is Rosie and Albert stumble upon Albert's mother, May Peterson.
Let me stop you to tell that they plant it firmly in your mind that Albert is a terrible husband.
Oh, Albert is a terrible person.
Yes. They get off the bus. It's like the middle of the desert. Rosie's lugging this luggage around, and he's doing a tap number called You Can Count on Me.
Yeah, it's kind of hit home pretty hard about 49 times in the first 30 minutes of the play how housewifey Rosie is, and it's kind of gross. And also, Albert is a horrible person in this play.
Terrible.
He's kind of a dick in the first one, but in this one, like, his behavior is irredeemable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so picking up, they run into his mother, who is inexplicably bartending at the club that Conrad last performed in Arizona.
What are the chances?
What are the f-ing chances? I mean, this is nonsense. Okay, so she hurls some insults at Rose. Surprise, surprise. Rose sings a honky-tonk number with the cowboys in the bar for some reason, and then they go to the mayor for help. The mayor looks a lot like late-stage Elvis. He burps, and they realize it's that Mayor C.B. Townsend is C.B. Conrad Birdie. It should be noted that Conrad is also planning on running for the Senate. That will be a plot point later that also won't actually matter, but remember it. There's a funny bit where, like, you know, a paunchy Conrad is like squeezed into his old gold suit, which of course doesn't fit anymore. And so that's like, I guess we probably were expecting that. So they make him perform Honestly Sincere as, like, you know, trying to get him to, like, get that performance
sincere.
Buzz back.
You gotta be sincere.
You gotta feel it here. That's in the crotch, not the heart. Okay, so the audience hates it because it's 1981, and instead they want the punk rock band Filth to play, and that's when Rose and Albert discover that their kids are not in New Jersey.
So let's stop right there. Okay. I'm pretty sure 2 days has passed. How in 2 days
Albert,
did this kid did this kid join a band, practice, write songs, make a set list, get out to Arizona, and dye his hair pink? I'm so lost.
Okay. So the story only gets crazier from here. So even though everything is terrible at the end of Act 1, Albert sings a show-stopping act finale called Back in Showbiz Again. Because even though, like, it's stressful and things aren't working and the deadline is approaching and they don't have a plan, he's like, oh, isn't this great? I love this feeling.
Yeah.
More about that song later. So Act 2 begins, and sometime during the 15 minutes of intermission, Albert realizes what a mess he's actually in and sings a totally opposite song called The Middle-Aged Blues. Oof. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's where things take a bizarre turn for the worse. Albert's mother... I can't even do this. Albert's mother brings in a sexy bombshell lawyer and karate expert who she calls Rose Number Two, who Albert starts to fall in love with during Rose's absence as she's trying to pull their fucking family back together and bring her punk son to go save their drugged out daughter from the cult.
So let me make this clear. As Albert is falling in love with Rose 2, Rosie is infiltrating a cult to rescue her daughter.
Yes,
and
correct.
She rescues her by distracting them with a dance number.
What number is that?
I think it's the one you were singing at the beginning.
Inner peace. Inner yes. peace.
Oh, God, that's a fucking bad song. Okay, so...
Are you still with us, audience?
How could they be?
Go get a drink.
I had to read the synopsis 4 times before I even...
We're not
...was
done.
Able to get a grip on this plot. Okay, so Rose 2, like Hedy LaRose 2, decides to fake Conrad's death in a plot to avoid a lawsuit by NBC because
yep.
she's a legal genius. Uh-huh. And that's when Mtobe suddenly sings that gospel number at the funeral. Why he's in Arizona,
yes.
I don't know if that was ever explained. So then...
That's literally the only reason that character exists, is to sing a gospel number.
Right. That's about as token as it gets, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So then after Conrad's faked death funeral sequence, he suddenly gets a ton of fan letters from people who were thrilled to find out he's still alive. And then instead of running for Congress, he decides suddenly to run for president.
Mm-hmm.
So running for president means he's, you know, he shouldn't be appearing on any award ceremony. So now they don't have an act for the $20,000. All of this for $20,000. Just like...
Hold on, let me get an inflation.
Yes, how much was $20,000 in 1981? Maybe it'll mean more to us.
Also, we should mention during this time, like, Rose is gonna, like, leave Albert, and then they kind of made up at some point.
Yeah, so, like, the same as the plot from the first one?
Yes. It is $68,000 today.
Mm, still not worth it. Nah. Just ask somebody for the $68,000. Do a GoFundMe. You'll probably make that much. All right, so anyway, Conrad won't perform after all, and the NBC exec demands an act in, like, 20 minutes or else. So then, Marla, in a plot twist that only M. Night Shyamalan could have
dreamed up... Wait, hold on. Before you even tell me that, mm-hmm. This is what it's the demand. This is what the producers demanded. They demanded Conrad, or quote, a reasonable facsimile.
A reasonable facsimile. Which, ta-da-da, the reasonable facsimile ends up being Albert's mother. Now, like, Albert's mother, Mae Peterson, classic Broadway character, you know, big fur coat, oversized handbag, just complaining about her son, like, insulting Rose, being the quintessential mother-in-law, annoying in all possible ways, apparently reveals herself to be none other than Dolores Zeppel, the toast of the 1920s. What?
Well, Albert had to get his music genius from somewhere, right?
But, like, if we can't accept, like, if we, the audience, are asked to accept that Mae Peterson just happens to be working barback in this random Arizona town, we are now expected to believe that she was an entertainer when she had nothing but, I mean, every other word out of her mouth is a complaint about, you know, Albert's career and the music industry.
Yeah, because she lived it.
Okay, all right. Well, anyway.
What's the final twist? Because the final twist is...
Okay, the final twist in... This is really dumb. Mae Peterson's stage name is Zeppel. Zeppel, spelled backwards, is Lopez. Lopez is a Latin name. May is actually Spanish, just like Rose. What? What?
And then they all forgive each other and...
Okay, so then, but like after all that, after Mae Peterson is the star, Conrad decides to sing after all, which negates the whole dumb Lopez thing. So anyway, Conrad sings... Rose and Albert then wrap up the entire show with Rosie, which is how the show wraps up originally in 1960. They sing the exact same song in, like, the curtain call.
Mm-hmm.
And then the curtain falls and you're supposed to go home humming the song that was written in 1960. I mean, honestly, it's funny how bad it is, but also it hurts my heart a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's taking these characters that we all know and love and removing them from their perfect little self-contained world of Bye Bye Birdie and just, like, throwing them into this 80s clusterfuck of a plot. It's
with
rude.
Country music and punk music and
just
still,
like
the old stuff. Like, it's so bad.
It's really not good. God, I wish I was in the audience. I wish I got to sit in the audience and watch it. Isn't it fun to watch a show crash and burn right in front of your eyes sometimes?
Yeah. I mean...
We got to see Bad Cinderella. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen a true disaster. I mean...
But, like, so you've seen clips of this show. Like, Cheetah Rivera is... I mean, she is a force to be reckoned with. This episode, yeah, despite all of its train wreckiness, is an homage to her. I mean... She passed away, and she is legendary. Like, running into Cheetah in New York was such a thrilling moment for anyone that's in the biz, you know? I mean, she is Rosie Alvarez. She is Kiss of the Spider-Woman. She is Gwen Verdon's dancing buddy, you know? I mean, West Side Story. That career is really epic, particularly for a woman of color. In the years that she was, you know, coming up in the business.
Yeah.
What, no, did she ever do Chorus Line? No.
I don't think so. Now.
The Sweet Charity movie. She's in that. All right, so that was the plot. That, I mean, come on. I couldn't believe it when I read it.
It was one of those plots where I kept screaming while I was typing it out. Like, this can't be real.
Okay, so nobody wanted to do this. Do you know about how people reacted when this was suggested by Tamz Whitmark?
I don't know how people reacted... Like, I don't know how people reacted in the biz. I know the audience is booed.
I mean, like, when Tamz came to the authors and composers to ask them what they thought of it, I think they all said nah.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I think they were like, this is a bad idea. I don't think this will work. And then negotiations continued, and then they were, like, obligated to write it, but didn't want to. I mean...
For $20,000.
What do you mean for $20,000?
What, just like Birdie? Like they, or just like
just Albert, like the plot?
They were offered $20,000.
Hey, maybe that's the reference that we're not seeing. It's like, oh, let's make it as f-ing ridiculous as we possibly can, and maybe like no one will notice. But
yeah,
I mean, it's just like they're not trying very hard, and maybe they put some decent amount of work into it, but their heart wasn't in it, you know, and that just comes from, we actually talked about that in Bad Cinderella. You know, the show felt like 10 different artists were all, like, tasked with this new project, and of course, everybody wants to work with Andrew Lloyd Webber, but when it comes down to it, if nobody is on the same page, nobody's individual contribution is ever going to be the thing that saves it, you know? Like, there has to be heart, there has to be, like, a vision, there has to be a, I don't know, some passion involved.
Speaking of not having your heart in it, did you know that O'Connor forgot his words to the song Middle Age Blues towards one of the final performances?
Yes.
And was just asked the band to help and then said, "You sing it. I hated this song anyway." Yes. And the audience was just like jaw on the floor.
Yeah, I read about that. I don't remember. Was that nugget in Not Since Carrie?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So he did forget the lyrics, but then in like a milking kind of a moment, he collapses on the stage in frustration, which doesn't really garner the laugh from the audience he expects, I think. And then, yeah, he's like begging the conductor to help, and it's not happening. You sing it. Wow. Oh, you know, we never mentioned that the show was directed by Joe Layton.
Of Barnum? Did he direct Barnum?
Yes, Joe Layton did Barnum and George M. But we've talked about him before in Tenderloin and Dear World and Sherry. He directed Sail Away with Elaine Stritch. Okay, so the show was, quote, conceived by Joe Layton, as well as directed and choreographed by. And actually, in one of the reviews, Douglas Watt actually mentions that the additional credit of the show being conceived by Joe Layton, he called it a bit rash. Oh, wait, hold on a second. So a couple other reviewers also mention Joe Layton's most recent misstep, which was Platinum. Do you know about that?
I don't know about that.
Platinum is a flop, not on our list yet. 1978. Add it to the list.
About?
I have no idea. I know that Jonathan Freeman was in it. Voice of Jafar, Jonathan Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know anything else about it. I don't know about the plot. I don't know who, you know. But several people say, like, Joe Layton really nailed it with Barnum, and it's just confusing how he wasn't able to do anything interesting with this show, but the show's not good, so how could he, really? So we talked about Tam's Whitmark, and, you know, obviously Bye Bye Birdie made a ton of money for its writers over the years. And made a lot of money for Tam's Whitmark, too, you know? I mean, even just the number of times Bye Bye Birdie was produced in the tri-state area alone, you know? So the story begins with the publisher wanting to make another buck, which we mentioned. And then Michael Stewart, who really was doing well at the time, was really not into it. He said from the beginning that it was a bad idea, and to have the show go anywhere except, like, you know, the just-released page of the Whitmark catalog was really, you know, not anything he was interested in. So maybe he jumped on board because that they did say that that's how they originally wanted it to be. But listen, no, you know who wasn't so hot in 1981 was Lee Adams. I mean, his last hit was Applause, and that was, you know, 11 years prior.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently Lee Adams was the one who talked everybody into it. Charles Strauss, I don't think, was very hard to convince. You know, I mean, Annie in 77 was still a major hit. He was getting plenty of income from that, but, you know, 1978's Broadway musical was legendarily a bad flop, and Charlie and Algernon, I've heard, is not much better. So they weren't getting any new accolades or profits at this point, so perhaps they thought that this might bring in a little bit of extra. But according to Stephen Susskind, the gang proceeded with grave misgivings. And when they pitched the whole idea of the musical to Gower Champion, his response was, quote, "Why are you doing it?" But nobody had an answer. But they did it anyway. And how?
What? Like, I mean, okay, so like, John,
yeah.
You know where my career is right now. I'll take anything.
Mm.
These are accomplished musical theater writers.
Yes, these are Tony Award winners.
I think it was Not Since Carrie said that it might be the biggest Broadway flop put on by musical theater profession. Like people who actually are well established in the business.
Right, exactly. You know, like, it would be funny if a high school, you know, drama teacher had written this. But they didn't. The actual writers wrote it. Okay, so first thing about the score, Marla, there is so much of that 1970s funky wah-wah pedal guitar.
I love wah-wah pedal guitar. God. You give me wah-wah pedal guitar.
It's so much. It's so funny. It starts like measure 8 in the overture and it never stops. Okay, during previews, a couple of songs were cut. You mentioned Don't Say F-A-T in front of Conrad, and there's another song called Shape Up that was cut. I don't know anything about that song. Most of the songs are sort of in the same positions, in the same point in the plot as the original, which also is really a bad move artistically, because all you're doing is reminding people of the show that's better.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I thought immediately, like, Jenny, the daughter, sings Moving Out in, like, the second song of Act One, and I'm like, oh, this is How Lovely to Be a Woman.
I mean, that was the whole thing, right? It was designed to be Birdie again.
Yeah, there's a song two-thirds of the way through Act One that is exactly like Put on a Happy Face, except it's not that song, it's an imitation of that song.
And then in Act Two, in almost the exact same place, you have, what was it called? When Will Grown-Ups
What's the Matter with Kids becomes When Will Grown-Ups Learn, or whatever that
grow
is.
Grow Up. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When Will Grown-Ups Grow Up. Oh. Yes. Now, I have to say, not every song in the show is terrible. There are some really cute show tunes in the score. But the bad songs are really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Woof.
Okay. So starting... Let's go through a few of our favorite good or bad lines. Starting at the top of the show, 20 happy years. I don't even know if this is a bad lyric or a good lyric. Two nice, healthy kids, summers in camp, Pocahontas. Love to see them smile. We still owe the orthodontist.
They rhymed Pocahontas with orthodontist?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, so Rose sings a song she sings her little housewife song early in the show,
mm-hmm.
and it's called I Like What I Do. It's like the fourth or fifth song. It's a homemaker song. She's amazing. She can sell any song, but it's not a good song, and the lyric is, yes, I'm a mom, yes, I'm a housewife. It's corny, but it's true. I like what I do. And then the sight gags in this number are like, she sings the word joy, she picks up a bottle of joy, she sings the word all, she picks up a box of laundry detergent, like, she says the word cheer, she has the fabric softener, these are like oversized props, like, what is this? What
do you think
is
they got
this?
Paid? Do you think there was marketing, like... Like, cheer and all paid them?
Oh.
For product placement?
I wonder. I would not be surprised. Okay, so then the ending of that particular song, after she finds out that the detective is planning to locate Mrs. Peterson, she gets all crazy and manic, and it's really fun. I mean, like I said, it's not surprising that Cheetah was actually nominated for an award for this, because she brings a certain life to the show that... She's working very hard.
No need for diamonds. Only go say it. I'm happy for instance. I like this life. Don't want any. I like what I do. Yes, I like my joy. And that's all I need for. Yes, I'm a mother. Yes, I'm a housewife. It's funny, but it's true. I do what I like. You know what I mean. I like what I do.
Okay, so... Cheetah's next big number is like this is the I Love My Abusive Husband song.
Oh, yep.
Mm-hmm. It's called A Man Worth Fighting For.
Yeah, so after they arrive in the desert and he's treating her like garbage, he goes to, I don't know, try to find Conrad, I guess, and she's left in the bar and sings to the random cowboys.
Yes. What? So It's like a country-esque song. The lyrics aren't anything like wild or fun, but just so you can see what kind of relationship they're setting up. He is dull and foolish and lazy. So my problem is, I'm crazy. Why don't I just up and go? Stupid me, I love him so. So you just gotta fight when your heart knows it's right. So I run back for more, 'cause he's worth fighting for. That's gross.
It doesn't even make sense.
Leave him.
Like, I don't want to...
Leave him.
Yeah. Don't... No. Oh, poor Cheetah. God, I wonder what it was like Cheetah and Donald O'Connor, like, sitting at the bar after week one of rehearsal together and being like, can you believe this shit?
It was nice knowing you. We won't be here for long.
Okay, so... Now, after that, there's a reprise of the opening number called Movin' Out.
A what? There was a what, John?
A reprise. I always say reprise. You're rude.
Go on.
Anyway, I thought Movin' Out was a pretty fun song. I'm not going to lie.
Eh.
Did you hate it?
Anything for me?
I don't know. I thought it was kind of cute. But, I don't know, did kids move out of their house in 1981 when they were 14?
I think they ran away.
Okay.
I liked Birdie's You Can Never Go Back song. I thought the lyrics were really funny.
I didn't hate that song. Yeah, that was okay.
Yeah. Here's some good lyrics from it. A billion times I heard We Love You, Conrad. If I had heard it one more time, I would have croaked. All the stupid trips I hated, both my hips were dislocated. My pants were so damn tight, I could have choked.
That's good.
There was always all them groupies walking wild. With the bleeding and the shelter, they were needing so much love and good. Walk up to the stage, I had to cross. Don't ever go back. Don't ever go back. Poor man must be free. And I've got to be me.
Okay, so I mentioned that at the end of Act One. Oh, we didn't talk about the third cut song.
Which was?
Filth. Do you know about this?
I don't know about this.
So the band Filth apparently sings a song called Filth. Or maybe the band is called something else and only their song is called Filth. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But anyway, apparently Filth got people so upset during previews that they cut it before the show opened. So Filth did not... The like rock band song within a show song, Filth didn't get performed in opening night or the three performances that followed because it was like a headache. Now, it's not on the album, but I think I have found a bootleg of it. It's a nightmare.
Ooh. I mean, just like to have a punk rock song in the middle of this seems bonkers.
Well, also a punk rock song written by Charles Strauss. I mean, it's like, yes. I don't want that. Also, okay, so to wrap up Act One, I told you that Albert sings this, like, you know, show-stopping tap number, but it's just an imitation of Put on a Happy Face. I don't know, it's just so, everything, the melody, the lyrics, the orchestrations, the tap routine, it's all just so unoriginal, but, you know, fun for a high school, I guess?
Let's talk about the song he hated, so much so that he stopped singing it, Middle Age Blues.
Oh, yes.
I mean, just too many references to Albert's dick to begin with. Went to bowling Tuesday evening, just feeling terrific. Woke up Wednesday morning and the wrong parts were stiff. My teeth are still okay, although my fillings hurt. No French fries, or else it's Malox for dessert.
No, no.
My friends know all my stories. I put them right to sleep. I drool at sexy pinups once. Now they only make me weep.
Oh, you didn't list my favorite one.
Oh, go.
I agree with editorials. My feet get cold. A little bursitis here, a little colitis there. Thickening waist, thinning hair. Get out of here. Did you just sing the word colitis at me? No, no, that is unacceptable. That is assault.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so here's something I want to point out.
Yeah.
So Donald O'Connor finishes the first act and starts the second act with songs that sound not entirely unlike and also end exactly the same. The act one opener ends with those middle-aged blues. And act one ends with back in showbiz again. Like, were they not even trying?
Oh, no.
For, when you force someone to write a musical against their will, terrible things happen. You sing it. I always hated this song anyway.
The only other song in Act 2 that I thought... I mean, did I even put anything down about the kids one? I don't know if I did.
We have to talk about Inner Peace.
Which one? Oh, Inner Peace.
Oh, that is bad.
I mean, it felt like I was back in Via Galactica.
I mean, the melody is basically Three Blind Mice.
Yeah.
Like, what? Imagine having to hear that piece of shit over and over again in the rehearsal room. It's supposed to be making fun of New Age philosophy, but honestly, it all seems a little dated. You know, it is 1981. It's like the dawn of the computer age. This all feels like stuff you'd be making fun of in 1969, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, have we not understood by this point what New Age is?
Just really quick on the topic of that out-of-place gospel number from The Detective. Jay Sharbert described it as... The whole thing is labored, muddled, with even a detective loose somewhere. One suspects he's mainly there for a rousing gospel number that seems as out of place as a door buzzer on a tomb.
Okay, these are the barbs. These are the theater critic barbs that I guess would be flying across the room, like Noel Coward and Cole Porter chatting away in a room together, like a doorbell on a tomb, or was it a buzzer?
A door buzzer on a tomb.
Oh my god, that's apt. It's apt.
She has a good. You song called Well I'm Not.
Yeah, that's a good one. I don't hate that. It has a really fun hook, too.
Thinks I'm gonna cry, well I'm not. Thinks I'm gonna die, well I'm not. Thinks I'm gonna mope around until I rot. Well I'm not, not a chair, well I'm not. He thinks that I feel small, but I don't. Thinks I'm gonna crawl, well I won't. Thinks that I think he's the only life I've got, well I don't.
So she sings that after she discovers Rose 2, like Busty Rose. Oh. When Will Grown-Ups Grow Up is a headache. I hated that. And then Albert sings Young at the end, like another one? It's another tap number. It's another song about being old or young or middle-aged or this or that. I'm like, yeah, we get it.
I think the writers were going through a crisis, a personal crisis.
Maybe. Who were they? What were they trying to say in 1981, you know? Tell a story that needs telling, boys.
Okay.
And then we mentioned the show ends with, now my life is rosy. And it's a great song, but I don't know. All right. Let's do it.
It's time for Critical Reception.
Ken Mendelbaum once said in his book, Not Since Carrie, The show may rank as the worst Broadway musical ever to be created by top-level professionals. I think that's the quote you were referencing earlier.
Yes.
He called it tasteless and ridiculous. Ethan Mordden, a theater historian, said very little of the score was even slightly listenable.
Frank Rich described the score as, quote, a death wish.
A death wish.
He says, the solo turns he has given to his stars are so flavorlessly repetitive that they blur into a continuous banality.
Wow.
He describes the scenery as, quote, a mild satirical notion that's so overdone, the show looks like a discount appliance outlet. Though Bring Back Birdie aspires to bring back everyone's happy youth, it has sent its creators and audience alike crashing into a gloomy middle age.
Yeah.
All right, who you got?
Clive Barnes' title was Send Back Birdie. He called it about as engaging as a wet flounder on a dry night. Stale, flat, and unprofitable. He said...
Try the fish early in the week.
Its jokes must have been left somewhere on the way to the theater. There at least were two stunning, gilt-edged performances, Rivera and Carnalova. A few decent numbers and a frenetically energetic staging by Joe Layton that sometimes resoundingly hits the bell. Okay. Cheetah Rivera, superwoman herself, tries, almost single-handedly, to get this heavier-than-lead dirigible off the ground. She is magnificent, she is commanding, and at least three times she shows her ability to stop a show that has never even started. Layton runs round the show with the manic energy of a little Dutch boy with only one pair of hands faced with a dam burst like a showering faucet. He does well, but nothing could be well enough. Then there's this quote. There is nothing much wrong with the rest that couldn't be put right by World War III.
Excuse me?
Are you comparing this musical to nuclear fallout? I think he is. The kind of show that teaches one to be grateful for small miracles, such as the final curtain. The very real spirit of the original show is here simply the specter at the famine.
Do you think if you put a bunch of critics into a room with each other, it's just going to be like old-timey insults at each other? Like, they're just going to, like...
Probably. All right, give me some Douglas Watt, Daily News.
Yes, Daily News. The article was named Fogbound Birdie Lost in Flight. Quote, Cheetah Rivera's great legs are as limber as ever, and she gives off sparks from head to toe whenever she's on stage. But all on her own, for Bring Back Birdie, last night's stale musical at the Martin Beck, in which she and Donald O'Connor are starred, is like some prehistoric beast gasping for breath in an alien environment.
Whoa.
Rarely have writers of this trio's attainment appeared less interested in their work.
Yes.
There were times when I felt as if I was watching a revival of one of those idiotic musicals of the 20s whose original score had been lost to be replaced with a patchwork of tunes by forgotten writers. When Bring Back Birdie isn't simply dragging itself across the stage in one dull music number after another and through a series of desperate plot developments, it is busy being tasteless. Too many cooks didn't spoil this broth.
Too many cooks.
It was sour. It was sour to begin with.
I think Douglas Watt nailed it on the head. That was a good one to end with. Yeah, desperate. The authors were not interested in the work, and it showed. Like, you can't. Yeah, I mean, it always baffles me. Like, all these stories about people out to make a buck, like, don't you know, though, that good artistic ideas take inspiration? Like, you have to support someone that has an artistic idea you believe in. You can't...
This is capitalism, John!
Yes, of course. Yes, you're right. It is the American or the capitalist system that requires people to pay people to make art. I mean...
Okay. Why did it fail?
Why did it fail? A stage sequel has never worked and never will. I mean, we didn't even talk about Love Never Dies, but it just doesn't work. Love Never Dies
might have come the closest to succeeding of a sequel, and yeah, that's saying a lot.
It was a big budget tour, yes. And it still was reviewed not well. I mean, I didn't see it. I would like to see it at some point if it ever tours again or if there's ever production.
I mean, there's a live recording of it.
Yeah, I have a friend who was in it, and I mean, the photos are great. It looks like an amazing company, but I don't, without having seen it, and I have not listened to it either, so I don't know.
Are you going to get tickets to the Jellicle Ball?
I kind of would like to see it, yeah. I mean, after having done Cats for 2 years. It. Yeah, I'm interested. I really kind of am intrigued to see what they decide to do. I bet it'll be... In my imagination, it's going to be sexy, and that's kind of what Cats is supposed to be, you know? Part of it, you know, it's also it's a story, it's storytelling, so I hope they tell some interesting stories with some different points of view, and you know, just like a human twist, a queer twist, I love it, I'm into it. You know, it is funny how I'm feeling about it now compared to when I first heard it was going to happen, and I thought to myself, God, what a disaster that'll be.
See, but... from the moment it was announced, I was so into it.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, the format does lend itself to some creativity, I hope they nail it.
Could it work today? I don't even think Bye Bye Birdie works today, so absolutely not.
Another reason why it didn't work is, the Fat Elvis trope. For as kind of gross as it is, it's funny and we laugh and whatever. But that's also kind of the, celebs at the end of their...
life.
Celebs in crisis, yeah. Celebs looking bad, celebs gaining weight. It's a thing. We, buy the tabloids and it's, a whole business.
You mean you do? I'm not into
Well,
that
people
stuff.
Do. I think it's disgusting, but I mean, I don't not watch the documentary after it's all said and done. It is interesting to me. I think the Britney Spears story is incredibly interesting, but I think she's been exploited enough where it all feels a little pornographic, you know, exploitative. Yeah. Did you watch the Nickelodeon documentary about the...
We haven't done... I mean, we haven't watched it yet.
It's hard to watch.
I mean, it's my whole FYP on TikTok is people talking about it. And getting... John, TikTok has turned into, for Gen Z, what Facebook is for your parents. Just bullshit conspiracy news.
Well, it's kind
of
a self-contained
thing,
right?
And Gen Z has no... no media literacy.
Oh dear.
It is hundreds of thousands of likes for people being Nickelodeon actually means, in Latin, I don't care about God. Or saying that the Nickelodeon's newest logo is the shape of Epstein Island. Could we stop?
Wait, but I saw that and I assumed it was a joke. Did somebody put
that
together for real?
It's not a joke.
Oh my God.
Everyone is what? I don't know what the original person intended who posted it, but...
It's gotta be a joke. Come on.
But that's not how the internet took it.
Oh, God. Well, somebody's always going to misinterpret a political cartoon, you know?
Yeah, but then you would think that it wouldn't get hundreds of thousands of likes.
Maybe it's getting likes for different reasons.
I'm reading the comments, John. It's
not. Oh, God. See, I'm glad I'm not on TikTok. I don't need that in my life. I have enough on Instagram. I need all of it out of my... I just need to go live in the woods. I want to be a hermit. That's my dream. Ugh. Why did the show fail? We're really relying on jokes about f***ing Hare Krishnas and punk music. Get out of here. Their humor is 8 years too late in its timeliness, and if you want to make something that's current and fresh, it's not this. For all that we've, talked shit about on this... poor decision. We have to also, we started by talking about Birdie. Let's wrap up by just talking about how, the real magic of the show, the original show, besides its, just it's enduring for a reason, but it made stars out of Adams and Strauss and Michael Stewart. They all hit it pretty big with that show early. And the same goes for Cheetah and Dick Van Dyke and maybe to a lesser extent Paul Lynde, because I think he was a little bit more established. It also made Gower Champion a sought-after choreographer, was his involvement in Birdie. It wasn't the biggest hit of all time, but it became iconic for its... It's a pretty good little show. It's a good packaged show. It's got kind of everything in it. And it's funny. I still laugh when I see Birdie.
Do you prefer the original movie or do you prefer the Jason Alexander Mark Kudish one?
I've seen the original movie and listened to the original score more than I've seen the made-for-TV one. But I have seen that one a couple times. I thought Jason Alexander was pretty cute. And who plays Rosie?
I don't remember who plays Rosie.
Oh, it's, what's her name?
Vanessa Williams.
Vanessa Williams, yes. Oh my god.
Tyne Daly was Mama Mae Peterson?
Yes, she was. The recording of Jason Alexander singing Rosie I know pretty well. Mm-hmm. But also that recording of Dick Van Dyke singing Put on a Happy Face, I mean, that's... That song in that show is, I think, the most misplaced, don't you think?
Yeah.
So many other songs in that show are really plot-driven and come out of the character's arc, but that song is like, hey, two sad girls on a bench, how about you cheer up? Will we ever see you again? Do you have names? No.
What role do you think I played in Bye Bye Birdie, John?
Played?
Yeah.
Harvey Johnson?
Damn! Good for you!
Okay, I know you pretty well.
I got it because Harvey Johnson dropped out.
Up! You step up to the plate.
Someone else dropped out and Harvey Johnson stepped into that role.
Somebody got bumped, yeah. A little bumper Romeo. Yeah.
All right.
Bye
bye, Birdie!
Thank you for joining us for this episode.
Follow us on Instagram at Flap of the Heap or email us at show@flapoftheheappodcast.com to suggest our next flop.
Like and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you happen to be listening, and be sure to leave us a comment.
The Flap of the Heap podcast is researched, recorded, edited, and produced by me, Marla Alpert.
And me, John Bowe.
Learn more about how you can support our floptastic endeavors by joining us at patreon.com/flopoftheheappodcast.
For as little as $5 a month, you too can be a Flop of the Heap podcast supporter.
Until next time.
So long.
Now my life is rosy, since I'm back with Rosie. With a girl like Rosie, how could I be blue? Hand in hand we'll mosey, me and little Rosie. We will be so cozy by a fire built for two.